Renee Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 434. It's March the 28th, 1980. That's side one of the tape. Now, isn't that a happy song for you this week? I took you away from that dismal and sad Sweeney Todd for a change. That's because it's spring, and I like spring, and I'm feeling good, I suppose. Also because it's about Annie, Little Orphan Annie, and we're going back to the Herbert Hoover era, so we may as well be prepared for Little Orphan Annie again. I do have some good news. I'm going to give you one story of good news. The Supreme Court upholds a prisoner's rights in mental cases. The United States Supreme Court, believe it or not, in a vote of 5-4, said the prisoners have the same constitutional protections as other citizens, and they cannot involuntarily be committed to mental hospitals. They have the right before commitment. That's something. The only problem is that they can be drugged before the hearing and be like vegetables so that they really don't have the free will to know whether or not they want to be committed. The big question is, what do they eat before the hearing? But in theory, it works out fine. I saved the life of Robert Hyde. Many of you know that story. And he was a prisoner whose name I got from Jack Kimbrough, a researcher on the Robert Kennedy assassination. And it was Sirhan's lawyer, Mr. Hansen, that told Kimbrough that Hyde was going to have a lobotomy. He was in Soledad Prison, and he was going to be sent to Vacaville, where the CIA was working on mind control programs, and they still do it there. It's a mental hospital in California for the intelligence community and the prison community, and Hyde was scheduled for a lobotomy there because he knew too much about the Robert Kennedy assassination, or that's what he was told, and there were several contracts out on his life, and I was lucky enough or able to move to stop those and also to stop the lobotomy by calling the warden, Mr. Clonan, and threatening to sue Vacaville Prison if they did it to him. He was put in that mental wing, and the lobotomy was stopped. Robert got out, and many of you have been to the house, and you've seen my huge Raggedy Ann. I have a 4-foot or 5-foot Raggedy Ann. He sent me when he got out of prison for saving him. You remember Raggedy Ann. She was all heart. But the point is that prisoners are sent against their wishes to these mental hospitals, and then once they're in, many are programmed to become killers and have electrode implants. This is what I believe happened to Dennis Sweeney, who killed Alan Lowenstein that we talked about last week. They're thrown into these mental hospitals, and they don't have a choice. And at least the Supreme Court is saying that they can't just involuntarily throw them into a place like that. There has to be a hearing about the commitment. Speaking of commitment, there's new evidence coming in about David Berkowitz, another fellow who described himself as the son of Sam, when the actual son of Sam, the neighbor living next to Mr. Berkowitz, was involved in the murders in New York City several summers ago. Authorities are looking into what they call the loose ends that a witness saw a yellow Volkswagen speeding from the scene of at least 6 of the shootings that have been charged to David Berkowitz, and David's car was parked at the time he got a parking ticket at the time of the last murder. This was a Volkswagen driven by a man, and it was chased through the streets of Brooklyn by a motorist who was near the scene where Stacy Moskowitz was murdered July 31, 1977. The witness said the man he saw had long, straight hair. David Berkowitz has stocky, curly hair, and Ms. Moskowitz was sitting in her car with her boyfriend, who was wounded at the time of the attack. David Berkowitz was overseas and in the service, writing letters home to a girlfriend, objecting to the war, wanting to get out and be part of the peace movement. And then he was put into hospitals and turned into a zombie to the point where he insisted he acted alone for these murders in New York City. And actually, people with descriptions other than his were seen at the scene of the crime. And the man that he complained about, this Sam Carr, his neighbor at Yonkers, who he said he was controlled by his dog and heard voices, this neighbor had two sons. One was killed on an army base last year, and another was killed hit-run case this year. And the one that was killed on the army base was a friend of David Berkowitz and fit the description of a person doing some of the murders. One of the investigators that tried to open this up this last year was punished for doing that, fired and reprimanded, but the case is still being investigated, and evidently somebody saw a car leaving and saw a description of the murderer, and even though David Berkowitz said he did them, the murderers are still at large, or the murder. There has to be a team. When this is covered so carefully, it has to be a well-developed plot. And speaking of plots, there was a article in the newspaper that most of you probably wouldn't even notice. I don't know if it was carried in your papers at all, but it interested me, and it involved a friend of mine, somebody who's still my friend. The article in the San Francisco Chronicle this week described the death of a man who said he was going to commit suicide, David W. Olson. He had an accident, he was shot, and it left him crippled. He had a severed spinal cord and eye damage. The San Jose Mercury described the same story but left out a part of the information which is essential to understanding this case. There was a conference of Mormons in Utah several years ago in 1977, and a friend of mine, Doug Wallace, an attorney, was trying to get blacks into the Mormon church as priests and members of the church, having more than just a membership role. And he was staying with a Mr. Fitzgerald in Utah. And at the time of the meeting that weekend, it was early in the morning, Saturday night or early Sunday morning, a policeman was stalking out the house of Mr. Fitzgerald with the purpose, obviously the purpose, of murdering Doug Wallace, who had come to Utah at this time. But a plainclothes man from the police department, David W. Olson, was going up to the house probably for the same purpose of getting Doug Wallace. And one cop didn't recognize the plainclothes man as a plainclothes man and shot him and paralyzed him. So he was wounded by another member of the Salt Lake City Police Department. And the San Francisco Chronicle, interestingly enough, said that on April 3rd, 1977, they were staking out excommunicated Mormon dissident Doug Wallace near a Salt Lake City residence on the morning of the church conference. Olson left some notes, again, those famous suicide notes, and he said that he would die, that he left them on a tape and made funeral arrangements. But the man who shot Olson evidently had orders to shoot. The one who shot him and paralyzed him was never punished, and he's still on the police force. But Olson, in his mind, knows what they were going to do to Doug Wallace, and now he's gone. On tape number 266, that goes way back to April the 25th, 1977, Doug Wallace was on my program on KLRB, and it's on the tape. Some of you have it, or you can order it, where he talks about the attempted shooting on his life. We did another tape December 4th, tape number 298, on trying to file a suit. He's a lawyer in Texas to exhume the body that's allegedly Howard Hughes. We wanted to file this suit saying that it's Vance Cooper buried in that grave in Houston, Texas. I've known Doug for a long time. He came through here about a month ago, and he got a trailer, and he's traveling around the country for a while. But his life was spared when one policeman shot the other plainclothes policeman. But that's the way Murderville USA goes. That's why I'm keeping track of so many judges and lawyers and civil rights spokesmen that are murdered, because they are planned and they are worked out with the police department of the city, the Salt Lake Police Department, the Mormon Church. They were all in on this murder attempt of Doug Wallace, and now one of the people involved who was shot instead of Doug just died this week. It is really a tragic waste of energy that people that study history can't apply it or learn by the past experiences, and they have to go through such tragic events over and over again. We're out now marching this next week against the nuclear buildings that were to be constructed in California. This is an anniversary of the first year of Three Mile Island, and some of the old community people will be marching one more time. We worked together during the anti-war movement, and we're at San Francisco at Kezar Stadium in 1967, and now we're on the brink of another war and nuclear holocaust, or the leakage of nuclear plants without any provision of what to do with the waste, and we will be out there marching. And as we march, there's one gentleman who will be sure to take care of the protesters as soon as he can. The Scientologist, the Church of Scientology, has printed copies of the speeches of Adolf Hitler on what to do with radicals and law and order, which were used by the Central Intelligence Agency during the war, last war in Vietnam. And when Ronald Reagan saw people protesting him in New York City just last week, he spoke up, and there were signs, "Reagan wants war." And this is a famous quote as of just last week of Ronald Reagan. "I'll tell you something, you jokers, if I did want war, you'd be where I'd start it." You people around the country don't know what 8 years of Reagan was here to the anti-war movement, to the protesters, to the mental hospitals, to the prisons, and the violence in the prisons. And all of his team are working their way up. So watch out for Ronald Reagan, no matter who runs against him. Get people to register and go to the polls. Reagan is now in the hands of the New York Central Intelligence Agency, the Trilateral, the Defense Department. He always was. But when he fired his group that got him into that position after his success in the primaries at New Hampshire, he took on William Casey. Now, William Casey is a one-time chairman of the Security Exchange Commission. Of course, that thing was so corrupt with all kinds of stock manipulations, it's hard to know who was behind the corruption there and how far it goes. He was in the OSS and then in the Central Intelligence Agency. Casey was chief of secret intelligence in Europe, which is the Reinhardt-Galen operation. Galen brought in the Tsarists, the White Russians, called the Vaslov's Army and the Solidaris, and they went down to Monaco and to Paris and into Germany and set up Adolf Hitler with the British right-wing fascist group, and after the Russian Revolution with Herbert Hoover and American fascists, they armed Hitler for the next war. And when that war was over, they brought those people back to this country and around the world to get ready for World War III. And the Tsarist group worked in the Hoover Tower, because Herbert Hoover was instrumental in getting them out of Eastern Europe and into the United States. And they worked at Stanford University. And that part I mentioned would be part of Ronald Reagan's cabinet. Reagan now has Mr. William Casey working for him. William Casey also was part of the campaign of Thomas Dewey in New York City in the 40s. Dewey went on to be the first candidate for presidency run by the Central Intelligence Agency and a group, the Mary Carter Payne Company, that went down to the Bahamas and became Resorts International Intertel. Again, the linking of organized crime and the Nazi organizations. And this Casey is going to be that. He'll be Reagan's John Mitchell. Running affairs in New York City, Nixon will be living next door to Rockefeller. But Reagan has taken on that New York ability now with the far right wing that was held by Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was too liberal for these people. Chase Manhattan was too liberal, and they're out. And this is the year of the Galen agents. And the aerospace, the Westinghouse, the military, the Defense Industry Security Command. Also, William Casey is very active in Catholic organizations and Catholic charities, and of course the use of the Vatican for espionage and spy control, and the links to these Tsarists and Polish fascists is very important, particularly John Paul II as Pope now. So Ronald Reagan is connected now east and west between the Stanford Hoover Library and the fascists that are there, and the Stanford Research and the mind control people. Now he's linked across this great nation to the New York Security Exchange, the stock market group that will manipulate him if they can to become president. Then out of the woodwork will come some of the meanest fascists that you've ever seen that are laying dormant, waiting for him, and he's a very passive Führer, because they will do the dirty work and he will be their front man. Jack Anderson has two articles this week I don't want to lose sight of in case you don't get his papers. I'm surprised that he's not synchronized more in around the country, but he has one on the U.S. ties with the Shah. This is a report by Representative George Hansen from Idaho, the Republican that went to Tehran two times. There are two committee chairmen. I'm giving you their names, Edward Boland from Massachusetts and Henry Roos from Wisconsin. And they're investigating the relationship of Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, William Rogers, and former CIA Director Richard Helms. Jack Anderson describes as of March 25, 1980, the lengthy, incestuous, perhaps illegal relationship of the Shah with top policymakers in Washington. I only ask the question, how in the world did Henry Kissinger become head of the National Security Council under the administration of Richard Nixon and carry on the wars he did and the policies against Salvador Allende or his policies with Iran? Henry Kissinger had this dual role and incestuous relationship all the time. He was a protege of the Rockefellers and Chase Manhattan. He married a woman who was on a paid salary of Chase Manhattan. He's a board member of the Chase Manhattan Bank. And that bank got $20 million a year from the Shah of Iran, raising the oil revenues. That was after King Faisal was killed, and I mentioned that before. Kissinger went to see him in Saudi Arabia, and the next, within a couple of days, he was dead, and he wanted to keep the price of oil down. But with the oil price going up, the profits go to Chase Manhattan. So you get a government, according to Mr. Hansen, where the president knew the hostages would be taken, but allowed the seizure of the embassy because the Shah had to get in the United States, that Chase Manhattan tied up money that they would have drawn out, that Iran could have drawn out to prevent billions of dollars being taken out of their particular bank, that papers have been turned over to the Soviet Union and the Iranian government when the embassy was overturned that didn't have to go. They've allowed this country to go down the drain, and the hostages could have been out by last November. All they needed is a Watergate-type investigation into America and Iran. But America and Iran equals Standard Oil, Rockefeller profits, and it also profits Henry Kissinger, and Henry Kissinger's protege, General Haig, will, I'm sure, run as vice president under Ronald Reagan, so all bases are covered. The military is happy, and then you again have Rockefeller, Kissinger control in the White House because Haig will be their man if Reagan takes him as vice president. It's interesting that that Jack Anderson is writing these stories. He's writing about that William Rogers, Secretary of the State at one time, important man with foreign policy, who as soon as he stepped down from his job became a part of the Bank of Omran, the Shah's money in Iran, and a director of the Pahlavi Foundation. When he resigned from office, he was working for the Shah, and he helped the Pahlavi Foundation put up their offices in New York City, a conduit of CIA oil money. How can a private family like the Rockefellers or a private business have so much influence in the State Department? I said last November when the hostages were taken and Jimmy Carter couldn't release them within a week that America had reached the turning point of its power to influence events around the world. And if you follow it each week and run through it, you'll see what I mean. The past year, I'm going to talk about Jimmy Carter just quickly, and I did want to get the abscam, but some of this is so important not to lose sight of. In the last year, the Shah was out of power. Somoza was out of power in Nicaragua, and Park was out of power in Korea. The next countries to go will be El Salvador and probably Taiwan and the Philippines and possibly Saudi Arabia. In the last year, there was elections in Rhodesia. South Africa simply has to take note of what's going on there. And the real story of the storming of Mecca is a top secret because of the weakness of the royal family in Saudi Arabia and the conflicts going on there at this time. Colombia is divided, and South American countries, El Salvador is in the throes of a revolution. The United States is still funding El Salvador, but no matter, even if Jimmy Carter was handpicked by David Rockefeller and Mr. Brzezinski, they do not control the thinking of the world anymore. That's why it's so important with tapes like this and articles that I'm getting from the newspaper and books that are available to read and study, because the forces of history are moving now and these individuals no longer have the control that they think they had. The British announced this week that they're going to compete in the Olympics. The killing of that priest in El Salvador will only unite the people against the United States. I read this week the United States keeps sending arms to El Salvador, but that brutal slaying of this fine Catholic priest, this Marxist, Mr. Romero, shot at mass, can do nothing but turn people on to what is going on to the United States if we keep sending them arms. There's rumor of a coup in Pakistan. that Mohammed Zia al-Haq is so unstable. He's the most flaky character in the world, and there's no way that we can keep sending weapons to these characters. The days of the Shah are over. There was a scheduled plot to get him. It didn't work, but believe me, he's walking on jello. He's so afraid of what's going to happen, that Russia will come in, that he couldn't take our minimum 43 million that he didn't want anyway. But the government is corrupt, and it's going, and Colombia has its own internal problems, where the far right wing is losing its power, the military dictatorship. Charles Krauss has a marvelous article this week about a woman, Regine Bentecourt de Lisca, known as Regina the 11th, who is running against communism and against the military dictatorship, and she's a tremendous power in Colombia, and her message is health, money, and love. I mean, those are the things that I would run on if I could run for office in this country, too. She has a following of hundreds of thousands of people, and she has free dental clinics, employment agencies, and she gives people subsidized hot meals. She's very pro-American. She's not a communist, but she has a lot of appeal, and there's a fascinating article. She claims that the government has never done anything for the poor, and if you believe in reincarnation or not, she was close as a child. She met the Pope Roncalli, Angelo Roncalli, John the 23rd, that very gentle, fine pope who I said died in the spring, early summer, just before John Kennedy was murdered. Kennedy and this pope had a lot in common and would have made peace in the world. She met him, and some of this rubbed off on her, and she claimed that Colombian politicians have never done anything for the poor, that she doesn't like poverty, that they've never done anything for education, that they've closed the hospitals, that they allow drugs to destroy the youth, that they've stolen a lot from the people. And this woman is a big influence working in Colombia. She's becoming a political force. She's winning elections. She's a woman who was inspired by a decent man. And the forces of good can influence you to take these actions, which she's doing, and get popular with the political people and hold positions of office in Bogota. She holds two city council jobs, and she's carrying on her work for mankind, as I say, not as a communist, but as a person. And these sound like cliches, don't they, like Valentine's? But good health and money and love, and if you have those, I believe you can conquer a lot. And she's something to observe. Her name is Regine Bentecourt de Lisca. They call her Regina the 11th. And she's getting very active politically in Colombia with a huge following. Jimmy Carter is calling for an extra vise on exports bound for the Soviet Union and to tighten up the technology bound for the Soviet Union. I have to tell you, it's an exercise in futility. It's simply like an oral masturbation. Remember, after Chiang Kai-shek was out in China, we were not going to give them technology. We weren't going to work with China. We stayed away from them. We didn't exchange trade. We didn't exchange culture. China survived. We're going bankrupt. This country's going bankrupt. And I just read this week that China has the missiles to reach the United States now. They had the hydrogen bomb without the United States aid, and now they have missiles that can hit the United States shores. That's a billion people that have been ostracized and kept from knowing or exchanging with major nations such as the United States, and they have technology. There isn't any reason to believe that what Jimmy Carter is doing to the Soviet Union because of Afghanistan makes a bit of difference. He wants to look like a strong leader, but the more he makes promises and the less he delivers, the more ridiculous it becomes. There's an article in the paper this week, Plane Readiness Report Stirs Dispute. The Pentagon would like to make war, but they've reported the U.S. airplanes aren't ready to go into battle. They don't think they could do it. Another one, a draft registration snag over a fund shift legislation. They can't get the money together. They have to cut off from one pocket to do the other to even get a draft together. The country's bankrupt, and they can't even transfer the $13 million it would be to get the list going. So we talk about war and holding back technology, but the one good thing is that we're not really ready, and by the time we're ready, the other nations will be smarter. Just as London's going into, or Great Britain is going over the Olympic Games, we're just going to look awfully silly and dumb because the problems in the Middle East we brought on, we won't apologize for them, and nobody wants to get involved with that Rockefeller, Kissinger, William's prophet system that we've brought a lot of chaos around the world, and the other countries are watching us and they don't want to be a part of it. I've done many tapes on the moon projects and the moon space stations, and I will get back to those after a few weeks of ABSCAM, but I just want to bring out three articles that were in the news just recently before we lose sight of them. One was Sanse Mercury. The Santa Clara University is going to have a study of space robots this summer. There's going to be American Engineering Society for Engineering Education involving a $202,000 grant. The question to be brought was, how much work will be done on the moon by robots and how much by humans? They're going to have long-term work with space stations and mining and construction projects. And the summer project this summer will be to see how long humans can stay on certain jobs and what can be done on robots so that they have a division of labor. Another article, NASA gives police power to captains of spaceships. This was in the Washington Post. NASA announced that the captain of the spaceship can discipline various persons. They can lock them in the bathroom until they land, that they have the authority with somebody in space to charge a crime and punish $5,000, and that they can use brute force. The main point about the meeting was to use brute force, that you can knock it out, that they're making reservations for space shuffles, and if there's any problem or fighting or a difference or mutiny on those shuffles, that you can knock a person down. And you need, they said, we need a rule like that because when the Apollos go up, those various moon ships and shuttle ships, there has to be some law. There were problems once on an airline in 1956, and also an Arctic case where when they were out at sea, they didn't know who had authority. So somebody in space has to make authority and use any means necessary, including physical force. So they worked this week on the law that you can use brute force when you're up in space if necessary, that the captain of the ship becomes the judge and the prosecutor at the time. He makes a decision and carries it out. Some countries are objecting to this law. They don't think that's fair. They have other nationalities that have made reservations for the space shuttle, and they're objecting to being tried in these cases, but they've been ruled out, and visitors from other countries will have to obey the laws on the spaceship, and the captain will be the one to dish out the punishment. There's also a problem with the moon treaty. There's a group called L.5. That is the group making arrangements for these weightless factories, and the L.5 has 3,600 members, and they have frightened Jimmy Carter. Now, they have a secret committee meeting on a treaty that involves the Defense Department, the CIA, the National Aeronautics and Space Agency, and the State Treasury and Commerce Departments. It has to do with taking minerals from the moon and using them privately for corporations or sharing them, the Moon Treaty. It has to do with iron, aluminum, titanium, and other minerals. And there's a lawyer, Birmingham Aerospace lawyer, who's working with the L5 group. That's Barry Goldwater, Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona, Richard Heinlein, who writes space science fiction, and Lee Ratner, a Washington lobbyist. And they claim that it would be space socialism to share the rocks and minerals with other countries, and they don't want to sign a moon treaty. France and Chile have signed it, and some people believe that the moon belongs to everybody, but these corporations, the Kennecott Copper Corporation and so forth, are involved on with these men that I've mentioned, and the L5 group, they don't want to have international socialism. This is capitalism at its best. Whoever gets up there gets the minerals, and they have put off any signing or agreements because Jimmy Carter is afraid of their secret committee meetings on this treaty, and I guess we'll have to wait till after elections to see what they decide. I bring out these moon treaties and these laws and space laws that are coming out now because there's many of you that are concerned with the past history, who refuse to understand what is being told to us about the plans for the space colonies and the slave labor and the possible genocide up there, similar to what the Nazis did at the rocket factories in Germany. To refuse to read these articles is to not be able to meet the future and to fight these people that are lobbying now for the control of the space colonies, both the resources and the riches, and control the crime problems and everything else. It'll be in the hands of a few up there. On side two of this tape, we'll go on to abscam and murder of crime figures and interconnecting murders that are taking place at the present time. Thank you.